And it's going. So today is July 1st, 2021. This is an oral history interview with Tom Zinnen. We are doing this remotely via Zoom. My name is Troy Reeves, and I am the oral historian for the UW-Madison Archives. This interview is being done for our Academic Staff Award winners oral history project. Tom, if you can help me out with sound quality, can you start by saying your name and spelling your last name?
Yes, my name is Tom Zinnen, and Zinnen is spelled Zinnen.
Okay, that is perfect. I've just turned up the recording on my end a little bit, and so we can speak at what we're the volume we're speaking at right now, and my tool should pick it up just fine.
Great.
So, Tom, I sent you the questions in advance. So the first one I want to start with is the first one on the list, and that is what brought you to UW-Madison?
Well, it's more likely what brought me back to UW-Madison. I first came to Madison as a junior at UW-Platteville. I drove a state van here to pick up some mice or something. I can't remember. I was working for the microbiologist, Marilyn Tufte, who's an alum of UW-Madison's bacteriology program. And I have a distinct memory of being stuck at a corner that I now know as Charter and University during class change. And I was astonished by the huge numbers of students, how long I was going to be stuck there, and the size of the buildings. And I'd been in the University of Illinois and I knew what big buildings were and stuff, but it was a distinct difference from Platteville. And then I came here in January of 1982 to go through my PhD program in plant pathology. I'd gotten my master's in plant pathology at the University of Illinois from 79 to 81. And so I was here from 82 to 85, and then I postdoced on the east side of town at Agrigenetics till August of 86. Then I went to Northern Illinois University from 86 to 91. And my friend Mike Grasmick sent me a newsletter in the fall of 19. Well, I think, yeah, must have been the fall of 1990, saying there was this outreach job in biotechnology available. And so I thought I could either stay at NIU and go through there, or I could return to Madison. And so I came back here as the biotechnology extension specialist, and started on Monday, the 3rd of June, 1991. It's one of the happier moments of my life to be able to see the state capitol in view as I drove up from Oregon, Illinois, excuse me, Oregon, Wisconsin, to see the capitol again, knowing I was going to get to live back in Wisconsin in general and Madison in particular.
Great, thank you, Tom. Just let you know, sometimes on my end, I'm gonna mute my mic when you're talking, so I don't get any background into my recording. So if there's a pause, sometimes it's just me unmuting my mic to ask my next question. So you talked about plant pathology. The next question is kind of taking you pre-UW Madison to talk about, what factors led to your work interest or your research interest in plant pathology.
Well, the story that I tell myself, excuse me, all of this stuff is perfectly sensible in retrospect. When it's happening, you don't know that it's important. But when I was a boy living at 118 College Avenue, my dad showed me in the side garden how you could pick the heads of dried marigold flowers off, and there were the seeds. And then the next year, next spring, we saved those seeds and planted them, and they grew, and we transplanted them, and that was very cool stuff. And then my grandpa Deutsch, who also lived in Dixon, Illinois, asked me if I would like to help him with his rather large garden. I always say it was about 130 acres. It was probably more like a half an acre. But when you're between fourth grade and fifth grade, and then again between fifth and sixth, it was a lot of work in a big garden, and I grew more different types of plants than I ever have since. My last name is Zinnen, and so and I went to the Catholic school in town. So when it came time to sign up to go to the Dixon High School, the public high school, I was the last kid in the last school to get to register. And I had wanted to take Woods as a freshman, only all the slots in Woods were taken. And the guidance counselor, who was a colleague of my dad, who was a guidance counselor, said, "Well, I happen to know Mr. Teakin, who's the ag teacher, because the teachers at the time were all that World War II generation, and the Teacons hosted our annual, well, their annual Memorial Day picnic. And he was an extraordinary character, so I ended up taking agriculture. That was a full year class, not just a one semester class the way Woods was. Got me involved in FFA. When I was February of that year, must have been February of 72, Mr. Teakin gave me a bunch of old tomato seeds to grow. And, well, not to grow, but to test. And he had a seed germinator, and he said, well, take and count these seeds out, make 10 rows of 10 columns of these tomato seeds on some brown paper, hand paper, and keep them warm and put them in the seed germinator. And so I did that, and a week later, none of them had grown. And he said, well, what are you going to conclude? And I said, the seeds aren't any good. And he said, how do you know it wasn't the germinator? I said, I don't know. And he said, well, here's some fresh seeds, not so many of them, but here's some fresh seeds. Go ahead and redo the test, only this time run it side by side, 100 fresh seeds, 100 old seeds, and see what happens. And so the fresh seeds did germinate, and hardly any of the old ones didn't germinate. So that was my first controlled experiment where you actually did something side by side. And that's been a huge theme of my work ever since. The next thing was, he said, well, now that we have these seedlings, why don't you transplant them into these little pots, and then we can grow them up and grow them under lights, and you can have some tomato plants. I said, that's great. And I started to do that. And he said, well, wait, you can't touch these plants. And I said, well, why not? And he said, well, your mom smokes. I said, so? And he said, well, there's a virus called tobacco mosaic virus in tobacco, and it can get on your mom's hands. And it would get on the doorknobs and get on your hands, and so you can't touch these. And I said, well, that's a tobacco virus. This is tomato. And he says, it doesn't matter. This virus, even though it's called tobacco mosaic virus, can still get onto tomato. So what you have to do is not touch the seedlings. You got to make little chopsticks out of wooden plant sticks. And so that's what I ended up doing. So the irony of that is, that was 1972. In March of 1985, I got my PhD at the University of Wisconsin-Madison in plant pathology, working on tobacco mosaic virus. And the first time I'd ever heard of it was from my ag teacher. And that was my introduction to, there are viruses, there are viruses of plants. Their names don't tell you what their host range is. And one way you control how they spread is by being careful how you touch the plants. So that's one of my favorite origin stories. If I'd ended up being a lawyer or something else, I would never retell that story. But because I ended up like this, it's a very influential story for me.
Thank you, Tom. So the other thing I want to talk about in terms of sort of your work reach and interest is, you know, we're going to talk more about what you do, but at least from what I can tell, what you do is a lot about communicating science to others. And so I wonder how you, if you've thought about what factors led to you being able to not only do science, but communicate it in a way that makes it understandable to others.
Yeah. Excuse me. It's weird because I bristle at being called a science communicator, not at you personally, but when people think I'm a science communicator, when I'm a science extension person, there is the professional science communication and it's a fine profession, and that's not what I do. It's not that I don't communicate science, but I'm the role in extension is to, for me, is to how do we develop people's own science savvy? It's not that I'm the shell answer man and I can explain things to you very well. Mm-hmm. I'm a coach and a coaxer. How do I show any individual person the connections of science as a way of probing the unknown, so that people are able to use their own science savvy better in making personal choices, informing public policies, and in making decisions in the face of uncertainty? And So I distinguish, it's like a lot of things. As you get closer and closer, you distinguish between things that most people don't even think there's any difference. But there is, and for me. And so to get back to the question, what's it take to talk well to people? One, I was always pretty good at, what do you call it? Tutoring other people, being able to explain things and distill things. If I was better at doing that to myself, I could have been smarter, but I was pretty good at it. One of the scenes I love in the movies is the scene in the movie Big when Tom Hanks, as an adult, explains to the fourth grader how shooting free throws is a way to look at percentages. And being able to find the right analogy is a great thing, both in science communication and in work in science extension, like I do. One of the reasons finding the right analogy isn't knowable until you try it, is that the way extension people look at it is that communication begins with the ears. And that's a big deal. Learning how to listen, learning that listening is at least as important as speaking. Realizing that different people are going to be saying different things, and you got to listen to what they have to say so that you can keep hitting the ball back and forth over the net with them while you're having a conversation is a huge deal. So, from that point of view, the listening is different since so much of what I do is oral, both oral in the mouth and oral in the ear, A-U-R-A-L, and you know that better than anybody because you do oral history both ways. That's a very big deal. The other thing is the impression I have out of most science communication is that they're trying to explain what we know. And for what I'm trying to do is help people get to how do we figure out what we don't know and what are the powers and limits of science. And I made up a wordplay long ago. There's this, the branch of philosophy that's called epistemology. That's the branch of philosophy that asks what is knowable, what is the nature of proof and disproof. And if you take the word epistemology and then capitalize the STEM, you get epistemology, and STEM is this acronym for the last 25 years, standing for science, technology, engineering, and math, which if you know epistemology, they don't have anything together at all. So why they're together, I don't know, but they are. So, but that's what I'm getting at, is that what I do is about coaching and coaxing people to develop their own science savvy. And if there's ever been a year where this has really been vital, it's been since January of 2020 to right now, July of 2021, with COVID. And the previous year where that was most important was 2019, and the year before that would have been 2018, etc. It just becomes more vital every year as we have all kinds of what are they called? Conspiracy theories that rise very high in the public domain and in the highest halls of power. And so being able to arm people with the valor of being able to ask, wait a minute, how do you know that? How do you show that? How do you know it's not some way else? The distinction between I prove something versus I disprove something. The idea that scientists are trying to find things by disproof and not trying to convince people by proof. Those are all big shifts of mindset. And that's what I like.
Thank you, Tom, again for that. So the next question, I think you've kind of answered in this last question, but I always like to ask them directly and see where they go. So, when you're asked, what do you do? How do you describe what do you do?
So I have to back people off from. I often ask them what do you think I do, so that I can get an idea of what's already in their heads. I always have an impression of what somebody does. It's usually not a very good impression, and I mean not of the person, but I'm not very accurate at knowing what people do till I talk to them. So the big thing is, I say my job, what I've made my job into, is connecting the public to the people, places, and programs of their public land grant research university. And the reason for that isn't to advance the university, it's not to promote any particular technology. It is, again, to me, back to help, how do you help people in their lifelong learning become more scientifically savvy? My job is not to make young people into scientists. I have no aspiration whatsoever to funnel people into a pipeline. I take a very liberal arts approach to science. I've gotten in more than one discussions with organizations that have Greek letters that keep conflating the humanities with the liberal arts. And I will not let anybody tell me that my biology degree from the University of Wisconsin-Platteville is not a liberal arts degree. And that's how I look at what I do is the liberal arts, the burning yearning to know about nature and about humanity is what this is about for me. And be able to share that with the highest aspiration, that burning yearning to know. Is what I try to get across. So, how do you do that? Well, one is to let people know by asking them this question, who owns the university? And then by asking them the follow-up question, are you a taxpayer? It's very interesting to ask people who owns the university, the UW system in general, the UW Madison in particular, to hear what the answers are. Especially since I work with kids that are in fourth grade and sixth grade and high school, and then with adults and with retirees. It's a good thing to see on their face when they realize that they are, if you live in Wisconsin, you are one of 5.9 million co-owners of the University of Wisconsin system and UW-Madison. And then when I ask the kids, especially fourth graders, are you guys taxpayers? Oh, no. My parents sure are, but I'm not. And then I ask them, well, you go into the store to buy $1 Snickers bar, how much more do you have to leave at the store than just a buck? And at least some of them know it's $1.06. And one of the most powerful things about the sales tax, regressive of a tax though it may be, one of the most powerful things about the sales tax is that it makes every kid who buys their own candy, clothes, or computers, or anything like that in the state of Wisconsin, it makes them a co-owner of this place. And so there's an issue of stewardship of the scientific enterprise that's really important to get across, that you are a co-owner of your public universities, including your public land grant research university, UW-Madison, and that even if you're in fourth grade, you are a co-funder. And so you have a stewardship obligation and an opportunity. The obligation is to maintain the public resource, and the opportunity is to use it and advance yourself and your community by taking advantage of the resources that are there. And so that's a big part of what I do from motivation. Why do this? If you're asking what are the mechanics of what I do, in my first 4 years, when the Biotech Center was still at the Enzyme Institute at 1710 University in the East Wing there, I didn't have any space where I could welcome people to campus. So almost all the things I did were on the road. Or I organized presentations by researchers so that my extension colleagues could come to Madison and hear presentations by them. But this wasn't at the Biotech Center, that was at Union South or Memorial Union or somewhere else. Well, in 1993, the university broke land for the new biotechnology center, and that groundbreaking was right in front of the old University High, because the first thing I had to do is tear down old University High, which is also at 425 Henry Mall, raise that to the ground, and then build up the new biotech center. In the summer of 1995, Dick Burgess, who's the founding director of the biotech center and the person who hired me in January of 1991, walked me over to the biotech center. I had to have hard hats on and everything because it was still under construction. And walked me into a room that was a lab on the first floor, and he said, "Tom, how would you like to have an outreach lab?" And I said, "That'd be great. said, how would you like to have two outreach labs? Even better. So that's how it came to be that the program that I lead shares with the undergraduate laboratory class in the genetics department, these two labs, 1340 and 1330, that were originally intended to be research labs and were originally intended to be two of the four labs that were going to be the home of a human genome project funded major center for DNA sequencing that would focus on bacteria, because Fred Blattner's group here had already sequenced was in the middle of sequencing E. coli in the basement of genetics. And so that building was built, the new building was built with the idea there would be four labs dedicated to that project. For whatever reason, UW-Madison was not selected as one of those major DNA sequencing sites. And that's why I ended up getting to have labs. We went into that lab. Oh, the other thing that Dick asked me that day was, well, how do you want to have it change these labs? Reach. And I said, I wouldn't change a thing. These are authentic. These are clearly not teaching labs. These are research labs. And if we're going to have people only for short periods of time, little divots of time, I want to be able to make it a pivotal experience. And by not changing anything, even though the shelves are high and the benches are high, the lines of sight are not good, it's not a great place to do a teaching class in. But that's not what I'm doing. The whole idea was when people walk into this lab, they're walking into a real research lab. And that's the best part of it. It also saved a whole bunch of money by not having to tear things out, but that's not why I did it. So in October 16th of 1995, we moved into that building, or at least I did. It was staggered and different people moved in on different times, but that's the day that I moved in, and we've been using that space ever since to have field trip groups, mostly middle school, some high school, on occasion adult groups, groups like Grandparents University, the Wisconsin 4-H Summer Conference in June. That's the thing that distinguished us. Those were the two, as far as I know, I'll have to leave this up to the historians, as far as I know, those were the two first wet lab spaces dedicated to outreach on the UW-Madison campus. And so that was what really tuned me into what a big deal it was to have a place to be able to welcome people. And that led to the emphasis on hospitality. My friend Ken Smith is the lead person on the thinking on this. He always thought the university should project itself as a destination for exploration. He always thought that hospitality should be at the forefront of what we do, and therefore we needed venues commensurate with the outreach aspirations of the university. And that new building gave us a pretty good start on that. And that's when my work shifted to, in order to defend that space, because that space was very precious space. We didn't have a whole lot of brand new laboratory research space at that time. One of the weird things about being an academic staff person in outreach is, especially for cooperative extension, we get funded by federal money every year, but it's not considered grant money. And it doesn't come with overhead. And overhead is the coin of the realm. And so it's something that I had to take into consideration if I'm going to defend this space. And my major professor, Bob Fulton in plant pathology, had already tuned me into how important it was, especially for greenhouse space, to always defend your space. And your best way to defend your space is to use it and see that people see that you're using it. And so that's why being able to do public events at the Biotech Center was so important. That allowed engagement. It allowed me to welcome people to a community of researchers who view science not as what we know, but as figuring out what we don't know yet. And that's very different than what people get when they go to museums, science museums. Science museums, you know, they have great science exhibits, but it's all about what people know. And here, by coming to the university, we don't have interactive science exhibits but we do have interactive scientists. And the emphasis isn't on, oh, here's what we know. It's on, wow, this is what we don't know. And here's how we're trying to figure this out. And that's where the science savvy comes in. And that's where grasping why being part of the scientific research enterprise as a taxpayer, the state taxes or federal taxes, and my being a co-owner, and most of all, by being a steward of these public resources, is such a big deal to me.
Thank you, Tom. So I have a question about, you know, what comprises a typical day, but I might punt on that for a second since you're now talking about sort of defending that space. And I wonder if you can talk about some specific programs that you've utilized to help defend that space. I have a few in mind, but I just wonder, just by asking it broadly, what you would focus on.
Well, the first thing we do is we have field trips come in, and we used to organize the field trips pretty much ourselves. And then I can't remember how long ago it is. It seems like a long time. It might've been in the mid 2004, 2006, whatever, but there's the campus visitor program set up a office specifically for orchestrating field trips. So that's a big deal because that means I can focus more of my time on leading and doing the field trips and less time on the nuts and bolts. There's still a lot of nuts and bolts time, but not nearly as if I had to coordinate field trips. So for example, in fourth grade in Wisconsin, fourth graders learn about Wisconsin history and government. So you see lots of yellow school buses coming into town all the time, and they're heading to the state capitol, and we gave them very little reason to stop at their public land grant research university. And by having a campus field trip office, we could present to people the option of not only going to the state capitol, but also then driving another mile and a half west before you drove home to come and explore science at their public land grant research university. So I can do about 25 kids at a time. That's one class. A lot of times people are coming with three or four or five classes. The great thing about that office for field trips is that we could then do round robins. And those are the folks that would do the professional work of coordinating with my colleagues in horticulture at the physics museum, at the geology museum, after December 2nd of 2010 at the Discovery Center, Discovery Building, at the Wisconsin Energy Institute, Allen Gardens, Babcock Hall, places that meant that we could welcome a group of 100 students, four groups of 25, by doing a round robin. And I already mentioned the Discovery Building, Wisconsin Institutes for Discovery Building, which opened in December of 2010. Right across the street from that, on April 15th of 2011, the new Union South opened. And those two buildings really revolutionized the center part of campus. I think that Union South could have been renamed Union Central because it's so central to the life of the university now compared to the previous Union South, which was designed by Joseph Stalin on a bad day. And to be able to have those places, additional hospitality, the lunch options, this all made us a much better destination. That's one kind of thing that we do. In 2005, I was working with Sarah Shute, who at that time was split between the Alumni Association and the Division of Continuing Education. And there was what was called an Osher Center for Lifelong Learning, something like that. And Sarah was leading that. And she and I put together this program called Wednesday Night at the Lab. And the whole idea was, hey, you know, arts does it, athletics does it. What if science folks did it? And by doing it, I mean, what if we welcome people to campus every day in an organized way, so that people would know there was a destination that they could come to. So Wednesday night at the lab does not do that, but that's what we're aspiring to, is that if it's Wednesday night, it must be Wednesday night at the lab, which is a play on if it's Sunday morning, it must be Meet the Press or Face the Nation. I can't remember which one it is. So in December of 2005, we launched the pilot programs for that. In January of 2006, we found out we got funding from the Baldwin folks to fund the first 2 years of Wednesday night at the lab on February 16th of, I think it was February 16th of 2006. We launched Wednesday night at the lab, and it's been going every Wednesday night 50 times a year ever since. And that was a big change for our building, because up until that time, the building was locked at 6 o'clock. There was no reason for people to come into that building, or so the whole mindset was. So at least since then, the whole idea of public being in the building in the evening has become a regular part. And that shift in mindset, when is it okay and in what buildings is it okay for the public to be in their public land grant research university, is a big deal to me. In October of 2007, we started a partnership with, at that time, Wisconsin Public Television, now PBS Wisconsin, because in 2005, 2006, 2007, what was on the horizon was the coming of digital television. And the opening up of digital television was going to mean that PBS went from having, or Wisconsin Public Television went from having a little bitty bandwidth like this to a big bandwidth, and what were they going to do to fill that space? One of the ironies is that when I interviewed in January of 1991, one of the things that Dick Burgess asked me was if there was something that I could do, and if I had a magic wand, what would it be? And I said, well, when I was at Platteville, it always amazed me on public television, I could watch Wisconsin Badger football team. I could watch the Wisconsin Badger basketball team. I could watch the Wisconsin, at that time, men's hockey team. I never saw any science. So here you have one of the largest research universities by budget in the country. You got one of the proudest traditions of public broadcasting. Public radio was invented on our campus. Public bar TV was pioneered on our campus. Wow. But we, you can learn all kinds of stuff about what's happening in London or Boston, but we don't seem to do anything in science. So what was great about that was the expanding of the going digital meant there was a much bigger pipeline, which meant they had much bigger programming bill to fill. And one of those things was University Place. And one of the things that University Place was willing to do was to record on-campus lectures in any field. And since I had Wednesday night at the lab all queued up, and we'd already been running for a year and a half, they started coming and recording the presentations. At that time, we had started in 1360, which is a conference room, and which was very great. It was, everything was in a circle. It was just like a seminar, a laboratory seminar. We would go around the room first, and all the guests would say their name and all this stuff, and then the presenter would speak. The folks at PBS Wisconsin said we would probably record almost all of these if we could record in the auditorium, because we can set up there and the lighting is better and the acoustics are better. So for the benefit of having a broadcast quality recording that would then be broadcast and then be available on the website, I gave up the intimacy of the seminar in 1360, and we moved over to the auditorium, room 1111, and that's where we've been ever since. So that's another thing that I do, is since that's 50 times a year, lining up those speakers, promoting it. That's a significant chunk of time. At that same time, in 2006, Paul Brandel, who's a member of the participatory learning and teaching organization. I had to think about it because it's called Plato. And he's a UW alum and moved back to Madison to retire, which is another thing that's amazing. I hope I can remember to mention the fact that Madison has gone from being a place that you flee to a place that you come to retire is a big deal for science outreach. Paul asked if I'd set up a Frontiers in Life Sciences seminar for Plato. They had like 30 classes and almost none of them were in the life sciences. So he and I have been doing that ever since. We met at the Biotech Center, but then parking became difficult. We met at the Wisconsin Center, eventually called the Pyle Center, but parking was still difficult because the closest place you could get good parking at was Lake Street. And then because UW Space Place had moved out to the Villager Mall at 2300 South Park Street and they had lots of parking, and Kay Crewall and Jim are very cordial and active. They've been hosting us for at least the last 12 or 13 years at Space Place. So that's another 20 speakers a year that I line up. And so that's a good chunk of what I do. And then in the last 2 years, 3 years, when I shifted from being a family living extension state specialist over to being a Wisconsin 4-H state specialist. I do much more extension programming now because I'm doing programming with my county-based colleagues in 4-H, with the 4-H youth and other youth and community youth development programs. And I wandered there, but I'm hoping
That was great.
That's still answering your question.
Yep. And I want to make sure there's a couple of specific things that you may, I know Wednesday night at the lab was one thing I wanted you to talk about, and I might have follow-ups on that for the second, for the follow-up interview, but there was a couple other specific things. One was the BioTrek public outreach program. Did you talk about that? And
so my colleague, starting 1995, Cheryl Redman was very good at coming up with names for things. And she suggested the word BioTrek as a play on on Star Trek and the Biotechnology Center. And so as a way to brand that, we call our program the BioTrek Outreach Program. I added the idea that BioTrek, it's a journey through the living sciences. And to me, since the campus itself is such a great place to walk around, I talk about BioTrek tours of different buildings on campus and the X Marks the Spot tours. And that's a play on the Indiana Jones movie where X never, ever, ever marks the spot until, of course, you're at St. Mark's in Venice and it does. And to be able to walk people around and say, well, this is where vitamins were discovered. This is where warfarin was discovered and worked on. This is where four Nobel Prizes in medicine or physiology were won. And we haven't walked 150 yards from our place yet. This is the railroad running through campus that went from Madison to Prairie du Chien in 1857. And that was the interstate highway of its day. And that's why the state fairgrounds were in Madison in 1858 and 1859, because people from all over the state could bring themselves, their family, and their livestock, and they could stay at these state fairgrounds for 1-2 weeks. And so in 1861, when the Civil War broke out, that's where one of the two major places where the Wisconsin militia mustered. And our governor at the time was named Randall, and that's how Camp Randall got its name. And that's why to this day I sit here 2.5 blocks south of Camp Randall Memorial Stadium. To be able to tell stories like that, again, if the people are from Wisconsin, they are co-owners of what they see and what they walk upon. The health of the university depends on how they view their stewardship. And that's what's great. And I do not walk people around trying to convince them to go to college here. That is not my job. If they decide to go to school here, that's great. But I don't judge my success or failure based on how many people decide to come here. I'm about lifelong learning, and regardless of where you go to school or if you don't go to college, that's all fine with me. The big deal is I hope you aspire to lifelong learning and that you realize that you have resources at your public land grant research and extension university that you can tap into and come to for the rest of your life. And whether that's in person or online, or if we come to you, that's all great, but this is a high aspiration for American higher education, and I hope we keep that in mind.
Thanks, Tom. The other one that I had written down a specific name was Science Alliance.
Yeah. So, In 1998, Peyton Smith asked me if I would help organize one of four sesquicentennial events that were going to happen in 1999 at the 150th anniversary of the opening of the University of Wisconsin. I contend that the university was founded by the Constitution, so, May 29th, 1849, or I think that's the date. Is founding day to me, but other people say it was in 1849 when the first classes were taught. That's fine. The sesquicentennial was held in the summer of 1999, specifically so we could have lots of space for public events on campus. And I ended up organizing Cal's life sciences lunch. That was the first time on campus that I had to do what I now call science impresario work. An impresario is a guy like Saul Hurech, which nobody remembers anymore, or Uncle Max in The Sound of Music. An impresario is a fancy word for somebody who asks other people to do things, design and do events. And so that was the first time that I had really gone beyond the College of Ag and Life Sciences, which I'm not a part of. I've always been in the grad school or vice chancellor for UCR, vice chancellor for research and graduate education is the name for the last 7 years. But this time it allowed me to go a little wider and have an event that involved food and had the public at its focus, not solely my extension colleagues. And that was great. And then we did the next one the following year, and I was going to be happy to do this as an annual event. However, in 2000, and then again in 2001, there was a crash of the stock markets. There were two crashes, one right after 9/11 and one 2000, some one time, I can't remember. And that led the university to decide not to continue that. Those events. And that was dismaying, but that's what happened. In 2002, yes, in 2002, I think in the fall, Wren Singer, who was the woman who was in charge of the campus visitor and information center, eventually became known as CAVER, CAN, well, I can't keep track of all the acronyms. The big thing is, she said, Tom, would you like to organize a biotechnology public event? And I will give you $20,000 if you can do this. And I said, I would be happy to do it. But I don't want to do it only on biotechnology. I want to do it broadly. And I won't do it if you won't commit to it being a perennial event. I've already done this, and it's a lot of work to do the first year. It's a considerable amount of work to do it the second year. It's like a vineyard. You need to keep doing it year after year after year, if you want to get grapes out of it. And she committed to that. And so that's when we came up with the idea of UW Science Expeditions. And the planning group for that is what morphed into Science Alliance. The word science alliance is used by a lot of people. I first heard it when my nephew Luke Zinnen was wrote a poem about the relationship between the United States and Britain and during World War II. That's the kind of kid he was, still is. And he was talking about and the power of your science alliance. And when I heard that phrase, I wrote it down. This is years before this, but that's why I use that name. It conveys what it is. It's an alliance. It's spoken into existence. It has no charter. It works because all the academic staff people that make it work, make it work. There's almost nothing like it that I'm aware of at any other university. There are other communities of practice, but we haven't heard of one yet that's as wide-ranging as Science Alliance is. And I've had my ears open for many years, and you're probably interviewing Kevin Mimi. He's been a big player on the national level in science outreach at universities. He says there's nothing like Science Alliance. He ran Science Alliance for 10 years. So I'm very proud that we have something that we still have 15, 16, 17 people meeting every week during the school year. In the spring, we plan science expeditions. The metaphor that I use is that science expeditions is the trellis upon which we grow the community of the science outreach folks on campus. This university is remarkably blessed with lots and lots of events in science outreach. And science expeditions came out in part of me watching every other year the undergrads in engineering pull off Engineering Expo. And I often thought, geez, if they can do that, why can't we do that? And so when that opportunity came up, we did. And the big deal behind science expeditions to me is it's great to have this public open house to welcome people, not just the 3 days of the open house, but all 363 other days, so they're better able to navigate their land-grant university. But the big deal for me was it gave us a project where we could build the science outreach community. And so that's been a big deal. It's taken a long time, but we now have folks from the east part of campus participating in science expeditions, people on the west part of campus participating. We collaborate with Engineering Expo. We share a weekend. These are all things I'm pretty proud of. It's all social infrastructure. There, it has nothing to do with bricks. It has everything to do with bodies and souls and people being able to work together. And then the relationships that come out of science expeditions are also relationships that work throughout the year. So in the COVID year, when we had to shift over to everything on Zoom, my colleague Liz Jesse, who succeeded Cheryl Redmond when Cheryl retired 5 years ago, we were able to draw on folks from engineering, from the School of Medicine and Public Health, from nursing, from pharmacy, from LNS, as well as CALS. And that's all based on relationships that got going 18 years ago in the spring of 2003.
We're past 45 minutes, but we do have a few more minutes till 2. So if you're willing to maybe do a follow-up on that, because I'd like to ask a little bit more about one of the questions I asked about technology, but I want to put a pin in the technology one and just ask a little bit more about COVID, since it's fresh on everyone's mind, and how COVID affected what you did over the last, and has affected what you've done over the last, you know, now 15 months.
Well, I want to start by saying that Steve Orrick gave a Wednesday night at the lab for me in November of 2018 on the occasion of the centennial of the Spanish flu, the flu pandemic, and he focused specifically on Madison and the university. And his talk blew me away because here's the person getting his PhD in history. He's a retiree, he's a retired naval officer, he's a retired surgeon, and he stood up at the lectern and basically said, Neither the city nor the university handled this very well, nor did they remember it. They specifically chose to forget the pandemic and the policies that they put in place. Some understandable, some haven't stood the test of time so well. And I think when everything got shut down on the 13th, 14th of March of 2020, that all made pretty good sense. But soon thereafter came the word that outreachers could not do online work with one people. And out of that, the justification for that in part was online safety, which, okay, so we can deal with that. But the other one that really galled me and is a stain on the university to me is that part of the explanation for it was youth programming is not a core enterprise of the university. And I was sitting right here where I'm sitting right now when those words hit my ears. And it still is something that the university needs to deal with, that somebody from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, the home of the Wisconsin idea, would say youth programming is not a core enterprise. Therefore, we don't want you using our online resources. That eventually was, those words were never taken back, but eventually we were allowed to use Zooms and do Zooms and all that stuff. And that was great. It took a huge toll on my 4-H colleagues, on my community and youth development colleagues in the counties, especially last summer when they were not able to do any programming. And I understand that. In the summer of 2020, we barely had enough testing capacity, let alone, you know, we had no idea when vaccines would come. Here on the 1st of July of 2021, we know that vaccines arrived on December 14th of 2020, but we did not know that a year ago today. Being able to do things online had some very positive effects. It meant I could have, Liz, Jesse, and I could have collaborations with county colleagues in a way that we weren't able to before. Previously, we could drive out to a county. They might be having a, you know, a 4-H science day. Liz and I would do an exploration station. It was all very nice. Come and visit us. Maybe we'd get a reciprocal visit out of it. That was great. The online stuff allows us to have a sustained working relationship that was personable enough that we could get to know each other, tell jokes, understand when people were having good days and bad days. That carried over into the ability of the Zoom to, we could see in most cases how the kids were doing. That is huge. And that's a wonderful addition to what we can do. So that's, I don't want to say it's easy. I want to disabuse people of the idea that anybody immediately pivoted. It took a long time to figure out how to do this. We were not good at it. I don't know how good I am at it now. There were, in the first few weeks, we were just sitting there going, what are we going to do? And this is a great thing about the project that you do, is that I hope it defeats some of this perfect retrospectiveness. The historical inevitability. It was not inevitable that all this stuff would work out the way that it did. But people in Extension fought to let Zooms happen instead of WebExes or Microsoft Teams. It's like, this is really important. UW-Madison, I know it's only been 2 years since Cooperative Extension came back to be part of you, but you have to be able to use things that people in the counties are using, and people in the counties are using Zooms. And it's great that you might have concerns or contracts or whatever about these other things, but that's part of being a land-grant university with an extension function. And eventually they came around, and I hope that timetable becomes clear why they did what they did. They're going to have their explanations. But it was a big deal to be able to get this, be able to use this technology, this new technology. The other thing is, it took a long time to switch over for Wednesday night at the lab. Wednesday night at the lab was problematic, a challenge, because they needed to have broadcast quality recordings. And Zoom quality, although it's pretty darn good to me, isn't broadcast quality. And so here we are at the end of March, April, May, June. Wasn't, I don't know if it was in July, maybe it wasn't even till August. We started getting the idea of, and keep in mind, I put that slowly just to get you an idea. It's like, whoa, how are we going to get this? We have to get it so that the PBS Wisconsin University Place people are happy with it, that their engineers are happy with it, that there's a functional way to do this and be able to record presentations. How are we going to do Q&A? Do we even bother with Q&A? So it wasn't until the end of September that Tina Hauser and her crew had arrived at this idea that they were going to buy a laptop. They're going to buy a special laptop broadcast quality camera, special laptop lavalier make, a big old SanDisk hard drive, and get this all set up so that you could put it in a Pelican briefcase, high impact plastic, and to drop it off at people's homes. They would open it up. We would go through a tech check on Tuesdays at 2 o'clock, and Wednesdays at 2 o'clock, they would record their talk. We would be on a WebEx or whatever it was. It wasn't Zoom, they didn't use Zoom. So that we had four people from the PBS Wisconsin crew, myself tagging along, and then the presenter. And that's how we switched over to doing Wednesday night at the lab sessions of PBS Wisconsin's University Place. And we've been doing those at a rate of about two per month ever since. And their broadcast quality, they look pretty good. I've watched them on TV, I've watched them online, and that's a success story. But it wasn't fast, it took a lot. And there were a handful of months there where I didn't know what we were going to do. Once that happened, then I could resume doing Wednesday night at the labs by Zoom on Wednesday night. And luckily, I had very helpful and sharp undergrads who could help me on Wednesday night with the technical angles. The other big thing was when the new feature came into Zoom that all you had to do is hit live stream to YouTube. And not only could you have the Zoom where you registered for and people could see your face and you could speak, but you also had the live Zoom, excuse me, the live feed to YouTube, which allowed people to type in, but they didn't have to give you their names. They didn't have to register. And the big deal was the live stream got automatically recorded and archived onto the Wednesday night at the lab YouTube site. Those are some things that I think are going to be hard to remember in 2, 5, 10 years. The things that people look back now and go, oh, yeah, that happened. Of course, it happened. And it's like, well, when you're looking forward, you can't see what's going to happen tomorrow, let alone next week or next year. And I hope that's what one of the things these oral histories capture is it's the fog of what are we going to do now.
Thank you for that, Tom. So I'm going to wrap up for today. As I said when we emailed back and forth, I will do at least one follow-up interview because I'm sure there's things you still want to say and there's certainly questions I still want to ask. So this concludes the first session with Tom Zinn. And Tom, thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And it appears to be working. Okay. All right. Today is July 9th, 2021. This is a follow-up interview with Tom Zinnen. We are doing this remotely via Zoom. I'm in my home office in Madison, Wisconsin. My name is Troy Reeves, and I'm with the UW-Madison Oral History Program. So, Tom, like we did at the start of the first interview, to help me with my recording tool, can you say your name and spell your last name?
My name is Tom Zinnen. My last name is spelled Z with a zebra, Zinnen.
Okay, great. Thank you. All right, so we already have a list of things we would like to talk about. So I want to start with letting you, if there's anything from last time that you'd like to expand or clarify, because I think there was something about welcoming youth to campus that you want to talk a bit more about.
Over the course of my time here, the importance of being able to welcome the public in general and young people in particular has been a big part of what my work is in the theme of Science Alliance. And a distinguishing character of UW-Madison as a public land-grant research and extension university, that hospitality is a really big deal. And I think it's something to be very conscious of in the last year and a half, in particular over COVID, how the university has responded to welcoming the public to campus or not, and in particular how they've well, they just announced 2 weeks ago that young people would still not be allowed on campus and youth programs until September 8th. And so I think from a historical point of view, from a current point of view for me, it's a really important thing to note. This means we've had two lost summers as far as welcoming the public to campus for youth programs. And that can be a very damaging ripple effect as we move forward. Those cohorts of kids will not have had the same chance to come to campus and get to know the people, places, and programs of their public university, public land grant university. And so I think that's something to be conscious of. Just as I mentioned last time when Steve Orrick gave his talk about how the city of Madison and the University of Wisconsin responded to the 1918-1919 flu epidemic, we have to learn from decisions that we make and policies that we implement, and being aware of that is a tough one. There's, I think we had other options available to be able to welcome youth programs to campus this summer, and we chose not to. Even after on May 6th, the university system president issued this press release promising people that they would be welcoming youth to UW system campuses this summer because it's so important.
Thank you, Tom, for adding to that. So there's one thing, well, actually a couple of things, but the first thing I want to ask you, and this is something you talked about last time, alluded to last time that I wanted you to elaborate on, and that's the difference between liberal arts and the humanities. I was
Oh, yeah.
hoping you could discuss the differences you see then between those two things.
Yeah, well, the humanities are a subset of the liberal arts, as are the sciences and math. And when people start conflating those, as if when they say the liberal arts, they mean only humanities and they exclude the science and math parts of STEM, that gets my attention because it shifts how people look at the liberal arts. They disparage the liberal arts. They don't realize that to be a liberally educated person, which in some views that means that's the education required of a free person. You want to be able to be cogent in science and math. And for me, that includes the social sciences. And so in my outreach in science, I always make it real clear that my dad was a high school history teacher. I like history. I'm not here to convince anybody to go into science or to get a career in STEM, but I think it's really vital that people have a yearning for learning as broadly as possible, and that includes the liberal arts. One way to define what the liberal arts are or are not is to ask, what can you major in at a liberal arts college? My mother-in-law happened to live in North Adams, Massachusetts, which is right next to Williamstown, Massachusetts, which is where Williams College is, which is considered one of the premier liberal arts colleges in the country. It's important to the University of Wisconsin because we have two former UW presidents buried there, including John Bascom, because they came from Williams to Wisconsin. And at Williams, you can study humanities and performing arts and fine arts, and you can also major in chemistry and biology and physics and math, and those are all liberal arts. So for me, that's a big deal that we are clear that one of the reasons we want to have lifelong learning is so that people can have an education in the liberal arts, even if they don't have an opportunity to go to college and to major in those particular fields. And I'm in an area of extension with the Biotechnology Center, with life sciences, a step or two away from agriculture, that these are things that I get to bring to bear, and I'm very happy to do so. And that's also one of the reasons the range of topics and presenters I have for Wednesday night at the lab are so broad, so that we can have the full range of people, places, and programs at the university that bear on sciences, shared with viewers and the listeners Wednesday night at the lab.
Thank you for that, Tom. I want to get to one of the questions that was on my list from last time. I still have a couple of follow-ups, but as I said in the email, I'll pepper those throughout the time today. And the one of the questions from the follow-up that I didn't get to last time was, how have changes in technology changed your work?
When I arrived in 1991, I was typing on a Selectric typewriter. I sent mail out in an envelope with a stamp. I received mail in an envelope with a stamp. There was this thing that some people was using were using called email. I'd seen it used by a friend of mine who was in engineering at the University of Illinois, but it's like it wasn't going to do anything or go anywhere. Once again, I was incredibly prescient. Within 6 months, I think it was by the end of my first year, December of 91, not only did we have computers, but the computers all plugged into the wall now, to the Ethernet, and that wasn't just for printing. To be connected to the printer was the major reason to, and I used the wrong word, Ethernet was not around probably then, but anyway, you plugged your computer into the wall, and that way it could go to a printer, and you didn't have to have a printer attached to your computer. So this was networking early days for me, and I'm a very slow adopter. So that was the first big thing, the idea that we switched over to internet, and that a lot of our mail and communications then went to email. And then I think it was in 1994 that Dick Burgess, came into my office, if I remember right, and he said, Oh, you got this thing called Netscape, right? And I said, yeah, kind of. Or so he told me what to type on, and up came this document on my screen, and there was a couple of words that had a blue underline on it. And he said, you see that? And I go, yeah. He says, put your cursor on it and click it. I put my cursor on it and clicked it, and poof, a whole new page opened up, a whole new window. And I was stunned. It's like, whoa, what is that? And that was the first hot link I had ever clicked on. So that was my introduction to the power of the World Wide Web. It's hard to remember what a wild, wild west it was at the time, with what browsers, what software, how things were going to be arranged. But it was real clear to me that, geez, this is different. And I'm a very late adopter. So a friend of mine, Ken Smith, and I put together a couple of things we called the Terrace Conferences on, were on, and one of them was working the World Wide Web. And we invited outreachers from around the Midwest to come, and we had like a 2-day conference at the Wisconsin Center, which is now the Pyle Center. And we had other things where we brought in ag teachers and gave them the first
hint of HTML. So that was really powerful. And it was a shift away from how are we going to do things on paper with mail and a print shop and publications that you keep in a warehouse, and then you had to distribute them when people sent in their stamped self-addressed envelope, to wow, you put things up on this World Wide Web for free and people can use it. So in 1995, I remember seeing at home at 210 Campbell Street, it was the first ad on TV that it ever had a World Wide Web address on it, and it was a Toyota.com ad. And I was like, whoa, that was amazing, because that meant that it was coming into very much the mainstream. So that was one big thing that really worked out well. I think the coming of PDFs was also a big deal. It's hard to remember what that. Gee, when you started out, you had to send paper things out, especially if you wanted anything that had any illustrations. And you got portable document files or formats, whatever PDF stands for. Wow, you just send them an email and all the graphics and all the color there. And then eventually included the water that we swim in now. So those were amazing technologies that happened in the first 5 to 8 years that I was on the job here. The other one that was interesting was that had this thing called satellite video conferencing in 1991 and 92. The Cooperative Extension, which at that time was separate from UW-Madison, was part of UW hyphen extension, had a program where they were going to put satellite dishes on the roofs of the county offices in all 72 counties in Wisconsin. And then we would be able to have these satellite video conferences. So live, an extension person could be at the Wisconsin Public Television studios being recorded, and then people could have lower quality cameras or still cameras with audio at 72 places if it was a really big video conference. So this was going to change how we did things. And I did two separate satellite video conferences in 73 and 74. One was with CIRSE. I can't remember what CIRSE stands for. It's SERC. And the other one was a USDA-funded video conference on biotech and food. And that was pretty amazing, but it was also like, my goodness, there's no soul to this. You can't really see the people that are out there. It's much more like broadcast TV than it was by interactive. You couldn't tell a joke. If you did tell a joke, you couldn't tell whether the people got it, and they couldn't tell you a joke back. And that's the line that I was giving to people for the next 15, 20 years when I would go to national meetings and at the when people were having exhibits, and part of the exhibits were, oh, use our distance learning software, distance learning equipment. You don't have to travel. You can have these great video conference experiences. And I would say to them, can I tell a joke? Will the people get it? Can I tell that they got it? Can they tell me a joke back? And that was not the case until recently. And that's what was so amazing about the. I don't think I'd heard of the word Zoom, which is what we're meeting on now, in February of 2020. I just, that company was not on my radar, and I never did video conferences. So I think that's the other thing, is that we went from something that was probably a little premature in 1992, 93, and it's like, ugh, to wow, this is the core of my work for the last 18 months, is doing meetings like you and I are doing right now. And I can tell a bad joke, and I can tell when people get the bad joke, and they can tell me a bad joke back. And it's amazing. So those are the major ones that I can think of. Email, World Wide Web, portable document, PDFs, and then really effective for free Zoom conference or web conferencing. There might be others, but I'm drawing a blank on those.
Okay. Well, thank
Oh,
you.
I guess I would say YouTube specifically, because YouTube is such a big part of what we do with Wednesday Night at the Lab now. To have a free, high quality audio, visual, video archive of what we do. It used to be we would arrange all these meetings and have all these talks, and if we recorded them, we had one little cassette, and they were functionally archival materials that nobody would ever see. And now all these things are live, they're all live streamed, and within an hour, they're in an archive that anyone anywhere in the world can watch. That's astonishing. Glad I got that in.
Thank you, Tom, for that. So I do want to move. I'm going to try to get these other follow-up questions in at the end. But I do want to move to these questions about academic staff since we're interviewing you because you won an award. So when I offered the question about being involved in academic staff governance or groups, I think you in the email said you wanted to talk about visitor parking fees. And then some other things too. So I'm going to ask the question, were you involved in academic staff governance or groups? And I will let you answer it however you see fit.
Yeah, I was involved in the CASI, which is Committee on Academic Staff Issues. And then I was on the Academic Staff Assembly. One of the things that motivated this for me, first of all, I was familiar with shared governance in the University of Wisconsin system writ large, because I was involved in the residence hall council at UW-Platteville back in 76 to 79. And I had an idea that, it's the regents, the president, the chancellors, the faculty, the staff, at that time academic staff, the civil service staff, and then the students. And there was this Russian doll kind of nested thing that I was attuned to. So when I came here in 1991, I wasn't very involved in that, but I was very got very attuned to the idea of how important it was to welcome people to the campus and what things impeded the public from coming to campus. And one of the things has always been parking. And that's not unique to this university, is widespread in many universities of the size and scope of the University of Wisconsin-Madison. So I had tried from time to time to say, where can we get more parking for visitors, and where can we get bus parking? Why do, when we have these yellow school buses come in with 30, 40, 50 kids, we don't let them park on campus? We send them at best a lot 60. And one time we were sending them out to Alliant Energy Center, at that time Dane County Coliseum, to park there. It's like, well, that if you had a bus driver, that was fine. But in my experience, a lot of teachers were the drivers. And so you can't ask teachers who are also the bus drivers to about drive the bus away. So those were things that I was tuned to. And it was a huge deal when the Biotech Center building opened in October of 1995, that at that time they were building a parking structure for Lot 20 and attached to our building, because that meant that our building could be a really great destination for public events, and that's what I do for a living. And so I was very happy with that, and that it would be free parking after 4 o'clock and on weekends, and yay. And then over the years that kind of got eaten away. They started charging parking at, for fees at night and eventually on the weekends. And it's like, okay, this is, it's an auxiliary service. They have to make their money. Okay. But what really got me going was in on Leap Day, February 29th of 2012, the director of transportation services came to meet with me and five or six other folks from the biotech center. I was the low person on the totem pole there. And he proudly announced that we were not going to be having any raises in the rates charged to faculty and staff, but we are going after visitor parking. And those six words just stunned me, that the idea that we are going after visitor parking so that you faculty and staff don't have to pay more, but we're going to soak our visitors, really got to me. And there wasn't much I could do about it. But I didn't think it was very welcoming or hospitable. And it affected what I could do, especially since Wednesday night at the lab at that time was already in its sixth or seventh year. And I depended on being able to have easy parking. Didn't have to be free, but it had to be convenient and reasonable. Well, later that spring, for whatever reason, I had in the back of my mind, and it was probably from reading From Red Ink to Roses by Rick Tielander, that one of the things that Alan Fish had done when he came on to fix the hemorrhaging of red ink of the athletic department was to say in the late 80s, was to say, we're going to start charging more for parking. And we're going to start getting parking that athletics generates. They get to keep some, a lot, perhaps all of that parking money. That was pretty interesting. And for whatever reason, sometime, I can't remember what it was, but I stumbled on a chapter called, well, it's 36.11.8b. And that was a statute that said all fines and fees from parking on campuses, not just UW-Madison, but on any UW system campus, were to go only for parking, transportation. Excuse me, only for parking and transportation facilities. So somehow I heard that that's not how things were, that there was a lot of money going from parking fees to athletics. And I looked up all these statutes because one of the things that I'd done was I was a Congressional Science Fellow in 2000 and 2001, and I worked for the committee, House Committee on Agriculture, and I knew how to look up stuff. I'm not a lawyer, but I learned how to do stuff like that. Well, come to find out, there's this memorandum of understanding between the university transportation folks and athletics that basically shifted all this money over to athletics, and there was no statutory basis for it, and it was actually contrary to that. And this is not something that people were very happy to hear about when I went and talked to Randy Minorca or Marnocco or Walt Dickey and a couple other people that were on the campus transportation committee. The other guy, Dickey, was the lawyer for the athletics department. So here I am now going through the campus transportation committee, which is one of the big, powerful shared governance committees on campus, going to their meetings in September of 2012 and October of 2012, November 2012, December 2012. And basically hearing that, wow, no, this is a perfectly fine thing that we're doing, and it's an important part of our revenue. So after hearing that in December and saying that their lawyers were still looking into it, I went from that meeting to, I called the folks that were the leaders on the academics, no, on the Academic Staff Executive Council, ASEC. And I let them know what was going on. And then I talked to their counterparts on the university committee. And that was Mark Cook, who I knew from working with in the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences, although I'm in the grad school. And Mark Cook made things happen that afternoon. And by having a powerful shared governance, that's how that got moved ahead. And so the following months, January, February, is when the Legislative Audit Bureau came back and said, no, you can't do this. And by May, the athletic department had had to give back $702,000 that they had used as revenue to transportation. And that was all possible, I think, for two reasons. One, I was willing to stick my neck out because I didn't think it was, not only was it not legal, I didn't think it was right to have parking fees be diverted to athletics. It's also against the statutes. But I would have been stonewalled if we didn't have the Academic Staff Assembly and the Faculty Senate and the University Committee. That's what got people's attention. And I think that's also why there weren't any stronger recriminations against me than there were. So I think that's one reason why having robust governance, if we're not going to have unions, and that was that we, you know, we wouldn't, historically, the university would not have unions for academic staff and for faculty, but we would have very strong shared governance. We lost a lot of that with Act 10 in April of 2011 and more since. But whatever we have, I think it needs to be wielded and used and regarded as an important part of how we play a role as academic staff folks in the governance of the university.
Thank you, Tom. So also within your notes that you gave me, and I just want to make sure that if this isn't rolled up as part of what you just discussed, that you get a chance to, is it was a couple different things, like the utility of assembly meetings and then the uses of CASI committees, especially grad school CASI.
So for me, the utility of the academic staff assembly meeting, since to me, that was about how much time I wanted to put in it. The only committee I wanted to serve on was the transportation committee for what I just talked about. And not too surprisingly, I was never appointed to that committee. So I served on the academic staff assembly, and I that's the power to me of being able to go to a meeting that is run by the provost, and once a year the chancellor is there, is the power of, in the British Westminster parliamentary system, is basically Queen's questions. In other words, you have a chance to ask questions of the people who are leading the university. And that's something that I think is a powerful part of that. The ASEC gets to meet with provosts and chancellors quite often, but we get that chance 8-9 times a year at the academic staff meetings. It's a good way to let the leadership of the university, the chancellor, the provost, know what our concerns are and to be able to ask pointed questions in public that they need to be able to respond to.
Okay. And then the uses of CASI committees, especially grad school CASI?
So for me, the grad school CASI is different. How a governing body is constituted and who gets to pick up who's on it is a big deal. So the CASIs are interesting in that they're actually set up by the deans of the various colleges and schools. So they're quasi not part of shared governance, but they kind of are. They're advisory committees, but they're also selected by, they are delegates in the sense that they are, you get elected, not appointed. And I think that's another place to be able to go and say, here are our concerns, especially if the dean comes to the meetings. And Dean Cadwallader did a very good job of saying, I will come to half the meetings, which was a lot. And people told us that was a lot more than most other deans came to the CASI meetings of other colleges and schools. And he was a splendid person and listened to us and even respond, he listened when he got reports to the meeting and said he wasn't at. So I think that is again really vital. If you as a leader of a college or school want to know what your people are thinking and you don't have a union with shop stewards or whatever approach you want to do, it's great to have some sort of listening infrastructure. And I thought that's what those were for. And that's also why it's important to talk about things that are not pleasant, to be able to say, these are the things that are stressing us, these are the things that are affecting morale. And of course, starting with February of 2011 and Act 10 and all the repercussions after that. The following 4 years were a very hard time at UW-Madison for morale and for budgets, and those two play off each other. So I think that's something that I hope continues and that those committees are robust. And although they are advisory, I hope that they're able to be places where people can say, as I did, morale matters. What are you going to do about morale? How can you do more to acknowledge, and this is specifically in the graduate school, how can you do more to acknowledge people as they are going through their careers? What can you do for professional development, particularly being able to go to meetings? So these are some of the things, go to scientific meetings at distant places around the country, around the world, that cost a lot of money. So those were the kinds of themes that I brought because I thought it was important to keep ringing those bells quite often so that there was a sustained theme, a known set of concerns, and if it's advisory, all you can do is give the advice and try to persuade, but at least they got the advice. If they choose not to take it, it's on them. And that is a little bit different than academic staff assembly, where because of the shared governance, you have more sway. It's not a lot of sway, but you have some sway.
Thank you, Tom. So my next question is, do you think about the relationship between faculty and staff? And if so, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think a lot about that because I was faculty at Northern Illinois University. I was always been staff here. I've been staff within Cooperative Extension. Cooperative Extension has a lot of academic staff that do lots of controversial work in groundwater and pesticides, in my case, in biotechnology. And so, from a point of view of having credibility, having academic freedom, and even though you're not on a tenure track, nor will you get tenure, nor do we have any job protections anymore. At one time, I had an indefinite rolling horizon that all went away. Now I could be let go at any time, as I understand it. So it's really important to have an understanding of the powers and limits of academic staff people and the powers and limits of faculty people, to do as much as you can within the station. But also, in my case, it was real clear because of how controversial biotech and food was, I needed, and I think all scholars at the University of Wisconsin-Madison have that academic freedom. A lot of times people conflate tenure with academic freedom and vice versa. And for me, it's always been the idea I have academic freedom because I'm a scholar here and because the university says that I do. And that's what's so important about that brass plaque that's bolted to the wall on Bascom Hall. And I that's one of the things that concerns me about the power differential between faculty and academic staff, especially as more and more extension positions have been shifted to academic staff rather than faculty. Who is going to go to bat for the academic staff folks who are in tight positions? And if we have fewer and fewer of those folks and they have less and less influence, then I think that will have a chilling effect on the ability of all scholars at the university, but particularly academic staff people, to do their job and to do their duty and to stand up and speak out in their areas of professional expertise, especially when the area and the topic is controversial.
Thank you, Tom. So we're interviewing you today and last week, ostensibly because you won an academic staff award, specifically the Robert and Carol Heidemann Award for Excellence in Public Service and Outreach. So I wonder if you would talk as much as you would like about the award, you know, including the nomination through the reception.
Well, it's one of the great things that the Heidemanns did. I got to meet them once at their home, and then I talked to Carol on the phone after I found out that I had won the award. And I let her know that I thought it was really vital, especially for the identity of the University of Wisconsin-Madison, the Wisconsin idea, and how important outreach has been, not always at the university, but at least since the late 1880s, 1890s, that people like myself and my colleagues who spend their lives doing the public service, public outreach mission of the university, that we too can be acknowledged on a par with our colleagues in instruction and in research and in administration. I'd watched several colleagues that I knew win that award, and I was very happy for them. And I was like, boy, I would not mind being so acknowledged. And I was very happy to learn in 2020 that my boss had nominated me, but he let me know that I was not selected. The person who was selected, I know very well. And it's like, well, I can see, it's like, very good. And so I was happy that he and my other colleagues at the Biotech Center again nominated me, and I was delighted to win. It's one of my sayings when I do things with Science Alliance and help convene that and to co-organize science expeditions is that credit is infinitely divisible, and it should be commensurate with what the persons who are being acknowledged have done, but there's always room to offer credit to people, and I think that's something that the university would do well to do more of, and to have more opportunities to acknowledge people sooner in their career, early, middle, late. That's one thing they do very well with the faculty, and that we don't do so well with academic staff. If you saw and the other folks that I'm assuming that you have interviewed, almost all of them are 15 or 20 or 25, 30 years into their careers. And that means we have a lot of people who have 5, 10, 15 years into their careers who may not be getting acknowledged for the contributions that they've already made, the sacrifices that they have put forth. And it can really help keep people. We talk about recruitment and retention of faculty. We hardly ever talk about recruitment and retention of academic staff. And I think that's one of the things that we could do, and that I'm really grateful for the Heidemann Award and for the other awards that people won this spring. But there's only 8 or 9 or 10 awards, and we have 7,000 academic staff people. That's a ratio that could be addressed.
I've heard that the reception was virtual this year, or
Yes.
and I wonder if you have
Very well done.
thoughts about that.
It was very well done. We all knew that it was going to be virtual. It was harder, I think, for the folks last year because they were going to be live and then it wasn't. Very classy. A pamphlet that had a graphic artist work on it. The chancellor made the presentations. I thought it was first rate, and I'm very grateful to the academic staff, assembly, and ASEC, and to the secretary of the academic staff. It was a big deal for me. It was a big deal for my family. And have very fond memories and much gratitude for the ceremony.
Thank you, Tom, for that. I want to get to a couple more of my follow-up questions before we do the final question about legacy. One of them is actually one of the things that you want to talk about. You alluded to the last time about people who retired from campus not fleeing Madison, but actually either staying or coming back to Madison.
Yeah.
So how has that influenced or affected your work?
Last night I went to visit a friend who's subletting a 8th-story apartment at the 300 block of West Main. It's right across from Capitol Lakes. And it was an unbelievable view looking south onto Lake Monona. The sun was going down. It was 6:37, 7:30. And it was not any like any view of the city I've seen before. The only up high views that I've seen were from the state capitol, but this was different. And it just the way the city of Madison is different now from when I came here in January of 1982 is that this was a place that you would flee once you got done, whether you retired from state government or the university or any other thing. I mean, people were getting out of Dodge. And this is Madison. And then people were fleeing the Midwest in general. I grew up in Northern Illinois. Let's go to Florida. Let's go to Texas. Let's go to Arizona. Geez, let's go to Arkansas. At least they don't have any income tax. And to see in the 40 years since 1982 to now, that when I do programs with the Participatory Learning and Teaching Organization, PLATO, which is an organization of about 900 active retirees with college degrees, when I go around the room and ask the 25 people or so that are there, who are you and, how did you come to be in Madison? It's not unusual anymore for two or three of them out of the 20 or 25 to say, I just moved to Madison so I could be near my grandkids. I moved back to Madison because of all the great things that are here that I can afford. And that is a 180 degree shift. And that means there's more wealth, both financial and intellectual, in the town. It means we're being able to draw, attract, retain young people who want to come here for intellectually driven jobs. They get married and have kids, and those kids are grandkids to somebody, and those grandparents want to come and be by their grandkids in many cases. And so that testimony, that evidence, that is impressive to me because it allows us to think about ways that we can take advantage of in a good way. We can harness, we can put to work, we can invite, we can enroll, we can enlist. The older folks who are now, I'm in that age, who used to sit there and think, man, in a year or two, I'm going to head to Florida. I might come back for a couple of months in summer, but otherwise I'm gone. So I think it really increases the vibrancy of the community, and it really pumps up the vibrancy of what I can do with things like Wednesday night at the lab, which primarily has an active retiree with college degree audience. And then because we have programs like that, that means the experiences that our researchers and outreachers get in interacting with the older audiences hones their talents in being able to talk with other folks, whether it's teachers or parents of younger children or the younger children themselves. So I'm looking for a downside of this, but it's pretty hard. It's great to live in a city where you have a free zoo, a botanical garden that costs a dollar or two to get in, an arboretum that's free to walk through. The one, you know, and outstanding art museums, both the Chazen and the Madison Museum of Modern Art. The one thing we don't have yet is a large, robust commensurate with Wisconsin and with the University of Wisconsin Science Museum. And that's something that I'm hoping that over the coming years, some of these retired folks will see fit to put their time, energy, and money into. But it's a very impressive thing. And I think other university towns are seeing this. Thanks. And I think when people are asking, where do I want to retire to? Finding a university town, whether it's Platteville where I went undergrad or Eau Claire or Green Bay, those towns have another leg up on towns that don't have universities, and that is their ability to draw and retain retirees. So that's, to me, it's a wonderful thing about the last 40 years.
Thank you. You've mentioned Wednesday night at the lab a few times, and specifically at least one of the programs, one of the specific programs. And this might be like asking you to, you know, choose your favorite child, but I do want to ask, since you've been a part of it from the beginning, are there a few programs that stick out? And if so, why?
Yeah, clearly the one that Steve Ort gave really influenced me because of the power of what he had to say in his critique of the city of Madison and the University of Wisconsin as it was at the time, and how within a year it came to bear on how we are or are not responding to COVID. Plus, he was just a great storyteller. I think the other one is that stands out was the one that we had for the heart transplant case, story, saga, gift. There was a student who got meningitis and died in like 24 hours. And luckily, his family allowed his organs to be donated, and his organs went to 9, 10, 12 different people. One of the people that went to was a professor that I knew, And I happened to hear that, my goodness, he was in the hospital getting a heart transplant. Like, whoa. So I talked to that person, that professor, and said, this is a pretty hard but important story. Would you be willing to come and share your story at Wednesday night at the lab? And he said, not yet. It's too soon. And if I do, it would be only with the permission of the family. And so I said, completely understand. And about a year, I'd ask him from time to time. And about a year later, he said, I think we're ready. And so we lined up the surgical team, the mom, the professor, and they all told their stories of the young man getting ill, going to the hospital, being sent home, getting iller, more ill, going back to the hospital, and dying. And the harvesting of the organs and all this, so that the mom was particularly willing to share some insights that you wouldn't know unless you were there. So that's the one that affects me a lot. And it shows the power of people being able to share what they and the idea that when this young man died, because of the science and the medicine and the surgery and the infrastructure for quickly finding donors and being able to quickly get the organs into the recipients, what an amazing thing that is. And these are things that didn't happen very routinely when I was born in 1957. I think the first successful heart transplant was 1966 or 67, something like that. Kidneys were may have been earlier, and some other things, but that one was the other great one. And then the third one was the two cases of the MIA, the Missing in Action program, that my associate director or my boss, Chuck Kaczynski, launched. And that was work that the Biotech Center did to, in the first case, identify the remains of a Canadian citizen who was a U.S. soldier who was killed in August of 1944 in France, and then his bones were misidentified and misplaced. And they had to do a lot of sleuthing work, but they were able to, track all that down and use DNA to identify the bones properly. And then, so that was pretty good. And the second one was, Frank Fazekas. And that was amazing because I got to go to France in August of 2016 to help with the dig. Frank Fazekas was a Air Force Air Corps pilot who was shot down near Dunkirk in May of 1944. And his remains were never recovered. But that's what's great about this program is they figured out where the crash site was, got the permission of the French government and the local folks and the owners of the property. And that team went, and I got to carry a shovel and It so happened that Frank Fazekas, the pilot, had a 6-month-old son named Frank Fazekas Jr., who had grown up to become an Air Force pilot, was retired, and he was invited and he accepted. He came to the dig site and he was there on the days that we found the first remains. And the days that we found the first remains were the last 2 days before we had 2 weeks, and we didn't find anything until the last 2 days. And so that we got to have a Wednesday night at the lab on that, where Frank Fazekas Jr. came and got to share part of his story. So those are the good ones, tough ones.
Thank you, Tom. We're getting near the end, so I'm gonna scrap the question about graduate school. And finish with the legacy question. And that's, you're obviously not retiring today or tomorrow, but you have been here on campus for 30 years now, and more if you count your graduate school experience. So, what do you think you'll be remembered for? And is it what you want to be remembered for?
There are 20,000 employees or more at the University of Wisconsin Madison, and if you ask who, almost nobody gets remembered. They're presidents of the university that nobody knows, nobody remembers. So I guess the question is, what do you think you can do that will be a good thing? And I'm pretty open about saying there will be a university on the shores of Lake Mendota in 100 years, in 300 years, in 500 years. And it's an amazing thing to go to Cambridge in England and see universities that started in the 13th century. So anything that you can do to keep that going is pretty good. The thing that I liked is, I've mentioned him several times, my friend Ken Smith. He said, "Tom, you moved the pile." And I asked, "What did that mean?" And he said, "Well, university is a huge thing. You can't do lots about it, but you move the pile as far as helping the university be a more welcoming place, helping organize science outreachers, even if informally, setting up things like science expeditions and helping set up Wednesday night at the lab. That continues, doesn't, none of this stuff is brand new, but it continues that tradition and expectation that did start in the 1880s of being able to share science with the public here and all around the state of Wisconsin. So that reciprocity is really important, that if we want to be welcomed into communities around Wisconsin, we need to be able to welcome people here and to be able to help connect them. So, I think that's what my children will tell their children. That was a big theme of what I did. And in 3 generations, nobody will remember anybody. So, except they, then there's people like you that maintain archives, and then you never know who will go look at this stuff in a decade or a century.
Yeah, we certainly hope people will listen to this or look at what we have as the years continue.
I do want to put in a plug for what you do. It was amazing to me to be able to have, to be able to go see the speech from February 15th of 1905 that Charles Van Hise gave in the Red Gym, where his last paragraph was, "I shall never be content until the beneficent influence of the university reaches every family of the state." And there's a lot to be said for the real McCoys, to having the real deals, the primary documents. Those things are precious and powerful. I appreciate oral archives and physical archives, and it helps keep that story alive, and it helps also debunk baloney. And those are two pretty important functions.
Thank you, Tom. I appreciate you saying that. So this is going to wrap up the oral history. I'm going to hit stop on the rec my recording device, and then I'll talk to you for a minute or two, and then we'll hit stop on the other one. So, Tom, thank you for your time. I do appreciate it.
That's great.